came to America when he was 6 months old. He started as a stock boy at the grocery store. Eventually, he owned it. He turned it into the biggest grocery store chain in New York City. He now owns a real estate company worth over $2 billion. He ran for mayor of New York City. He almost won. You can't make this story up. This is the Katz Roundtable with John Catsimatidis.
Everywhere around the world, they come to America.
Good morning, New York. This is the Katz Roundtable. John Catsimatidis here Sunday morning. One great show for you today. Well, today is the Greek parade on Fifth Avenue in New York. So we got Archbishop Elpidor Fotos giving us his blessing. And we have Father Alex Kaloutsos giving us his blessing. Bruce Blakeman from Nassau County. Mike LePetri, running for Congress. Governor David Patterson. Steve Cates. Eric Shuflaw on New Jersey. And Dr. Peter Michalos, How Do We Live Longer? Let's begin the show with Mike Stoller on what's going on in real estate.
Good morning. This is Mike Stoller for the Stoller Real Estate Report on the Katz Roundtable. This morning, I have one of the leading real estate attorneys in the nation, somebody who's been noted by very few, very major publications and the organizations as probably New York's one and only real estate attorney.
Oh, my wife's going to be so happy.
We got to give a little. His name is Jay Neveloff. He is a member of the executive committee, chairman of the real estate department at Kramer Levin, Naftalis and Frankel. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, so what's really happening? We're here in the spring. Is it going to be a good year? What's going to happen in the real estate market?
I think it's going to be a terrific year, and because I want to let you know I'm putting my money where my mouth is, where we just extended an offer today to a very senior lawyer. We have plans to extend another offer to a senior lawyer. We expect to be very, very busy. And I don't know.
In good transactions or in bankruptcies and restructurings?
You know, I think every transaction, almost every transaction is going to emanate from the cycle we're coming out of. So for some people, it's an opportunity. For some people, it's distress. You have an environment where interest rates have stabilized. It's easier to underwrite a deal. People feeling pressure either from lenders or equity holders to do something with the deal. So yes, distress creates opportunity, and I think that's what's going to drive the market.
So where are the opportunities?
I'm going to leave office out of this for a moment. The opportunities are in transactions which may to most people look like they're troubled transactions. But in a recapitalization where the new money goes into the capital stack, defines whether that's a good investment or not a good investment. And that's a different analysis from whether the deal is a good deal or not a good deal. So whether it's a rental property, whether it's a for sale property, where you are in the capital stack defines the transaction. And I believe that most of the action has recently been and is going to be, continue to be, in recapitalizing transactions.
Okay, why don't you explain what you mean by recapitalizing transactions?
Take a typical real estate deal. It could be a rental property, could be an office, apartment building, retail. Rents aren't what they expected there to be. Occupancy rates aren't what they were hoping to be. So there are vacancies that need to be filled. There are shortfalls. Interest rates have been high over the past few years. So deals are running out of money. Putting aside what the cost was, just because the people bought it a long time ago or held it for a long time ago, they refinanced 5 years ago or 4 years ago. Those loans are becoming due. They need money. They haven't been able to pay full debt service or ground rent because they haven't had rental income. Those deals need money to stay alive, for the cycle to come back again, for the values to come back again. And a recapitalization is fresh money coming into a transaction.
And who is providing the money for the recapitalizations today? I mean, the banks are really stymied. The banks are out of the business.
I think you're right. That's an interesting topic to talk about, who the players are and where the money's coming from. And it's not, it used to be years ago, it was the commercial banks and it was the investment banks. Now you're seeing private equity funds with immense amount of money that's available to invest. You see family offices with huge wealth creation that's occurred over the past decade that have large portfolios. And they're different types of investors. And some deals are better suited for private equity investors where the funds have 7 to 10 year horizon. Other deals are more well suited for private families or family offices, which purport to have a longer time horizon. So it depends on the deal, but there's an immense amount of money. There's foreign money because investing in U.S. real estate is simply safer. It's historically a better investment than almost any place in the world.
What about the Chinese? I mean, you represented, I think, the Waldorf Astoria, which was a Chinese investor.
I still do represent the Waldorf. That's money, dealing with the Waldorf, that's money that's already in the U.S., it's already invested. And there are a lot of transactions where there's, whether it's Chinese money, Middle East money, European money, a lot of sovereign wealth is looking at deals and is in deals. So it's no longer the commercial banks, which were singularly the largest source of capital years ago. That's all changed.
What about insurance companies, CMBS and CLO?
They're all in the market. Insurance companies are certainly in the market. They probably have a less of an allocation to real estate than they did, let's say, 10 years ago. CMBS, again, is a whole other topic. CMBS is active. It's there. It is.
But certain companies say they never want to deal with CMBS.
Yes, and I think that the discussions I've had with clients for the past 20 years when they were looking for debt is it worth the X basis points because the cost of debt will be less expensive if it's CMBS. Is that worth the risk of having to deal with a servicer and a special servicer, the conflicts between the servicer not wanting to let go of the fees and turn over the special servicer, the difficulty in dealing with a special servicer, all those complications. So the question is whether in a lower interest rate environment where the spreads between commercial banks and CMBS are smaller, whether the difference in the rate is worth the potential of having difficulty in challenging times.
I'd like to thank Jay Nevelow for being here, and I'll see you next week.
Thank you, Michael.
With us this morning is His Eminence Archbishop Elpidio Fotis of America, and he is the Archbishop of Orthodox Church. And, Your Eminence, today is Greek Independence Day. There's a big parade. They're marching on Fifth Avenue, a proud day for all Greek Americans. Tell all our listeners how you feel about it.
Good morning, John. Thank you for inviting me to this audience day. I'm so happy that we are celebrating once again the Greek Independence Day. You know that the Greek civilization has offered to the entire world all the values and the ideals upon which the free world is built today, and especially the United States of America. We are the guardians of the Western values, and it's exactly identical, the same values that the Greek civilization has offered to the world. It's democracy, human dignity, arts, sports, everything. So coming together and celebrating the Greek Independence Day is not only for Greeks, but it's actually for all Americans, since we share the same values. And it's a festival of our nation to meet together and to enjoy the freedom and the democracy that we have established in our country, and to recognize the contribution of the Greek civilization in this. You know that the Greeks suffered almost 400 years under the dominion of the Ottoman Turks, and gaining back their freedom and their sovereignty over their own country is something that is inspired, as we all know, from the American Revolution, the War of Independence. So we have so many things in common to celebrate. I invite all Americans, all New Yorkers, to join the Greeks in celebrating freedom and the values of our democracy of the United States.
Thank you, Your Eminence, Archbishop Elpidio Fotis. I will be on Fifth Avenue with you, and we'll be marching up Fifth Avenue together and celebrating our heritage, our forefathers, and what created freedom and democracy in America. Thank you so much.
Thank you, my dear John. God bless you.
You are listening to the Cats Roundtable. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Cats Roundtable. With us today is Father Alex Kaloutsos. Today is Greek Independence Day, a big parade on Fifth Avenue. And he's also the recipient of the Medal of Freedom Award from President Biden. Father Alex, we catch you in time before you have to run to church. Tell us about Greek Independence Day, how you see things.
Well, you know, John, thank you very much for having me on here. One of the reasons why immigrants around the world, but specifically you and I and our families, respective families, we came to the United States, was that we had independence, that we could actually have a better life. And what a great celebration that we have as Americans of Greek heritage. Today is the great parade on Fifth Avenue, but it celebrates the birthplace of democracy, Greece, and the champion of democracy, which is America. And I think that that's a celebration. And thank you for mentioning the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And it celebrates, of course, something that JFK himself created many years ago. And he entrusted the President of the United States, who would follow him, to honor those people that live up to the principles of freedom from wherever they come in the world. And this is the time that we all celebrate independence. One of the great freedoms, of course, is freedom of religion. And we got to be constantly vigilant. If America doesn't stand strong, then I think that the rest of the nations around the world will weaken. We have a strong resolve as Americans, and I'm very proud of that. And that's why Greek Independence Day and what you do every day in your philanthropy and commitment and extra time. We thank you for doing that.
Father Alex, in the last couple of years, there seems to be an attack on religion. Where is this coming from? I mean, we all believe in a creator. Why are we fighting amongst ourselves? Why is there an attack on religion?
Well, can I tell you something? I'm really very concerned because, as you know, the First Amendment protects freedom of the press and freedom of religion, right? And I do believe there's been such an attack on America coming from disinformation, misinformation, twisting so many realities around us. And then you have people becoming belligerent and non-tolerant. Our rabbi, Arthur Schneier, is our mutual friend, always spoke about peace and tolerance with Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew. We did a conference many years ago about that kind of mutual respect. And we're losing it. And I think that also comes from many of us because we take our religion and our freedoms for granted. That's why everybody should be out there celebrating July 4th or for any spiritual, cultural tradition that celebrates independence. Because unless we affirm independence in the day, the privileges and the blessings of being free, we're going to lose it. We can't take that for granted. So what you're doing today has nothing simply to do with the Greek, and we're proud of that, but it's the principle of independence. That means religious freedom, freedom of the press. Those are the two fundamental rights that we as Americans should never take for granted. So what you're doing is combining the best of your legacy. I mean, look at the time you spent. I laugh about it many times. With all of the big businesses you're involved in, you're always the person dealing with people in the street, wherever they are. You're an uncommon man who deals with common things. That's what makes you special, John. And I thank you for bringing out Greek Independence Day today, but the way you stand up for principles, truth, justice, and the American way. That's America.
Thank you, Father Alex Kaloutsos, recipient of the Medal of Freedom Award. Thank you for everything you do, putting people together. We'll catch up again real soon. Thank you so much.
God bless. Thank you very God much. Bless. Thank you, my friend.
The Cats Roundtable.
What is this Sunday morning? Is Governor David Patterson? Governor Patterson, good morning.
Good morning, John. This particular Sunday, you know, over the past few days, it's been since the passing of O.J. Simpson, who died of prostate cancer at 76. But that whole era where he was tried and acquitted is probably going to be famous in American history. I wrote an article after it was dying down, and I don't remember whether they printed it in the Post or the Daily News, but the title of my article was "They Framed a Guilty Man." In other words, I always thought that O.J. Simpson was about as guilty as anyone could possibly be. But the fooling around with the evidence by the police and then the inability to freeze some of the DNA samples by law enforcement during that time opened the door for the jury, whose emotional state was probably already to acquit because they were only in the jury room for about an hour and a half before they came out with a verdict. But what I've always thought about this particular case is that it actually was the reflection of emotion from another case. And that was in 1992, the Rodney King case, where the officers were acquitted, even though you could see them beating a man who's defenseless. And I think that the anger from that era carried over to the jury at that trial and many people who cheered for the result of the jury's decision, which I think belies the truth. And so this is a new word I want to introduce into the English language, judicial karma. We see this over and over again where there's a terrible decision by a court or a jury, but it sets the stage for a very positive decision. So we had the situation with George Zimmerman in Florida, who shoots Trayvon Martin. He doesn't get convicted of anything. However, it sets the stage for the George Floyd case, where everybody was on the same page. The jury ran the table, and in that case, the police officer got a strong sentence, as he should have. So putting aside the emotion that people feel one way or the other about this case, I think one of the great things about it is that how it shows that the American system is not always right each time, but it certainly curves in the right direction. Or as Martin Luther King once said, that the arc of justice is slow, but it bends in the right direction.
So in other words, in your opinion, the O.J. was guilty, and eventually he got his part.
I don't see how you could be much more guilty than him. His blood was on the car. His blood was on the steering wheel. His blood was on the victims. He writes a letter to his lawyer, which looks like a suicide note, before that famous 10-mile-an-hour car chase up the road back in a few days after the situation. But I think that the tone of where the public was at that particular time inured to his benefit. But I think if you told people life or death, do they think he was guilty of the actual crime? They would have to say that he was.
What else is new this Sunday morning?
Well, what's not new, John, is that the budget isn't passed. And I said to you, I guess a couple of weeks ago, yeah, I wouldn't worry much about it as long as it happens in the first couple of weeks of April. No one will even remember it. But now we're getting toward the second part of April, and it's still not passed. And this is when, unfortunately, what conferences do, and I was in a conference where this happens, they dig in. Instead of saying, all right, what can we trade with each other to make this thing work, they become more glorified in trying to win all the arguments, and they're not negotiating anymore. And this is when you can have budgets that run as late as August 11th, which was how long it took to pass the budget in 2002 when I was a legislator. So my admonition to the legislator is to don't shut out the governor, don't refuse to talk or any that kind of thing. Don't delay a situation that makes New York State look bad. We're the only state whose budget deadline is April 1st. So if we're first in closing budgets, we should stay that way and have it passed before other deadlines come and go for other states, and they come in on time.
Well, who knows what's going to happen? We both advise Governor Hochul to hang tough, and the people of the city of New York, the state of New York, will hang in there with her. And I think this is the making of her career. Either she's going to be viewed as a very, very successful governor or not. This is the time, isn't it, Governor?
I think that the housing issue is at the center of the disagreement. And I think there certainly has to be affordable housing. But to have affordable housing, we have to put a lot of money into it, which means we have to take money away from other sources but it might be the right thing to do right now, because 428-1A, they should just tear it up and redo it and give the developers a chance to put the housing in place that all New Yorkers, I think, would appreciate.
Anything else you want to tell our listeners?
Well, I think it's just an interesting time right now in our history, not only as a state but as a country. And I'm just hoping as the year goes on that the debates, the national election, and everybody who becomes a part of it as Americans who registered to vote, that we do it with some thought about not only how it benefits us, but how it benefits our neighbors. That's what made our country great from its inception. That's what made it greater when we corrected some issues that weren't addressed at the time of the Revolutionary War. And that's what can make it great today and tomorrow.
Thank you, Governor Patterson. And we'll catch up with you again real soon. And God bless America.
And God bless you, John. Take care.
Thank you. You are listening to the Cats Roundtable. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Cats Roundtable. With us today is Bruce Blakeman, the county executive for Nassau County. Bruce Blakeman, welcome to the Cats Roundtable this Sunday morning. I read somewhere last week that you are going to be deputizing some people to protect their homes and protect their neighbors. Tell us what you're doing.
John, I have the power as county executive to declare an emergency, at which time I could, if I chose to, activate people to serve as special deputy sheriffs. So in anticipation of potentially having to do that and hoping that I never have to do it, I created a list of people that will go through training, and they would serve as provisional special deputy sheriffs in the event that there was some kind of dire emergency where we already had all hands on deck and we needed reinforcements. So primarily, these individuals would be protecting infrastructure such as hospitals, utilities, government buildings, mosques, churches, synagogues, things of that nature. They would not be going out on patrol. And I want to stress that it would only be in an emergency. So in the event there was a superstorm Sandy, or let's say the earthquake was worse, or a blackout, or whatever situation would put us in a circumstance where we would need additional help, rather than scramble at the last minute, all I've done is just pre-qualify people and create a list or a database of people that would be willing to serve and people who are qualified to serve, most of which are former law enforcement and military veterans. So it's nothing more than a list in a database. God forbid there should be such an emergency.
How many people do you anticipate deputizing?
Well, I think primarily we'd like to create a database of 100 individuals, but it is a process that they have to go through. They have to take extensive training in firearms. They have to take training in the penal laws and the use of deadly force, as well as other types of training measures.
And they're going to be they're reporting to the sheriff's department. They're going to be reporting to the Nassau County Police Department.
They would be under the direction of the Nassau County Sheriff.
There's some other things that are happening in Nassau County. You're going to allow LGBT competing girls' sports. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, it's really just protecting women's sports. We have a executive order that I signed whereby it states very simply that if you identify yourself as a female team, women or girls, or a league that's women or girls, that biological males cannot play. They can play against other males. They can play in a co-ed league. They can form their own transgender league. But what we have seen throughout the United States is men who then claim that they're transgender women trying to compete in women's sports. Women are getting injured. It's unfair competition, and it's unsafe. It's just common sense, and I think a lot of people are behind us on this because we're starting to see the various women's organizations now standing up and saying that it is just common sense and that they want to be protected. They don't want biological males who are bigger, faster, and stronger competing against girls.
That sounds like common sense, and I understand the Attorney General's office is thinking of suing you, or has been suing you?
Well, the Attorney General issued a cease and desist order via letter to me. We then decided that this needed to be adjudicated by the courts, so we brought a lawsuit in federal court. We are pursuing that lawsuit. We asked for a temporary restraining order. The judge denied our application. I don't know why. It just merely preserves the status quo because, you know, for the last 50 years, we've been trying to increase the rights of women to compete in sports. And that's just what we're doing here. We're not trying to exclude transgender athletes. There are other avenues that they can use to play sports and compete, but they shouldn't be stealing championships from women who have worked their whole life to be good at their sport. And they shouldn't be competing with women whereby they're putting women in danger, like those young girls who were playing basketball up in New England. And the coach of the girls' team took his team off the court because a couple of them got injured by a biological male who was much bigger than they were. So, again, this is just common sense. I can't imagine why people feel the necessity that biological males have to compete against females.
Bruce Blakeman, thank you for coming on this Sunday morning, and we'll catch up. Keep us informed of what's going on.
Thanks so much, John. Enjoy the rest of the day.
With us today is Michael LaPetri, and Michael is running for the famous Santos seat in, I guess, combined Nassau County and Queens County. Michael, welcome to the Cats Roundtable. Tell us who you are first, in case people don't know you.
Yeah, John, thanks so much. I'm running for New York 3. I'm a former New York State Assemblyman, 33 years old, somebody that's focused on making a difference, right? Giving a hometown voice to this district. I'm somebody that grew up on Long Island my entire life, and this district encompasses Nassau County, East Queens, and now West Huntington. And what's so unique about this district is the differences, not only geographically, but then also culturally, but also wealth-wise, business-wise. It's so great. And with my background as a New York State Assemblyman, it fits perfectly. I'm an attorney as well, and I hail back to the days of an Italian family, right? John, like, this is so important to me, is having that attitude of the right values, the right character, having integrity in this race, and showing that being a representative is about giving the people a voice, not for themselves, but for this district, and doing what's right, not what's easy. That's my background. It's where I came from. My mom was a nurse for 42 years in ICU and CCU. My dad worked for a utility company. I didn't come from a political family at all, anything of sorts. I don't come from wealth. I had to earn my way, hustle through straight up hard work, grit, tenacity, and moral fiber. Those are the values I learned, and that's what I'm bringing now. Well, we're giving this district a fresh start, somebody who's going to provide the next generation attitude of what needs to happen in government, bringing a 20th century government into the 21st century.
Now, you're going to be running against, you have no primary, so you're running for the November 5th race, is that correct?
Yeah, it is, there's a few people that have wanted to primary me. I'm not sure if they even made the ballot, so that's still being decided at this moment, if they're going to make the ballot or not. If they are, it'll be a June 25th primary. Otherwise, we are the nominee from the party, and through my background as a former state legislator, it's a perfect fit.
Now, you're running against Tom Suozzi, who won against Mazzi. And tell our people in Nassau County and Queens County the big difference between you and Tom Suozzi.
Big difference is I'm the guy that says it like it is and do what I'm going to say. Tom Suozzi is the guy that smiles in your face and stabs you in the back. We saw it years ago when he was a congressman. Don't forget, John, he's the guy that left this seat to pursue higher power. That's what he does. He did it with county executive. He left the seat to run for governor. Now with Congress, he left the seat to run for governor. That's what he's all about. I left the state assembly seat to run for Congress, and now I'm going to do it again where I want to have it, where we have a voice. The big difference is I stand with law enforcement. Tom Suozzi voted to repeal qualified immunity, where holds police officers personally liable in the conduct of their time as a police officer. Imagine that. Imagine being where they could be sued and their homes taken from them. Tom Suozzi voted to fund sanctuary cities.
This is John Katz from TV's. If you want to hear the full interview, go to WABCradio.com. With us this morning is Eric Schuffler, and he's our partner in the Ferry Hawks, and they're doing Well, I mean, he'll be telling us about that. And give us an update. What the heck is going on in New Jersey? There's a 15% raise coming from
New Jersey Transit.
New Jersey Transit. And on top of congestion pricing, somebody's getting punished here.
Yeah, it's expensive. It's expensive life in New York City and New Jersey. Transit hikes are going up 15%. You know, congestion pricing, which is, you know, coming out of New York City, being imposed on people. It's a grind to get to the, to get to work every day, and now it's going to hit you in the wallet a lot harder. It is expensive to live here.
And another whale died a couple of days ago. What's going on with my whale? I love whales, and I hate for them to be dying.
We hate it also, but yes, the mystery of why whales keep dying and popping up. That one I don't have an opinion on, really, no.
They're doing an autopsy, and I hope they find out what the heck happened, because... Don't forget the Star Trek thing where all the whales died and the whale monster was coming back to get even with us. Tell us again, ferry hooks.
So ferry hooks, big news. We open up in almost 3 weeks, John. May 3rd is our home opener, Friday night. Saturday, May 4th, we're having our first ever Faith in Family and fireworks night. So first fireworks of the year, May 4th on Staten Island with that great view of the backdrop. We're going to have a lot of our friends in the religious and faith community there. It's going to be a special, special weekend. And we have a pretty big signing we announced last week, John.
Tell us.
Pablo Sandoval, the Kung Fu Panda. Pablo Sandoval, three-time World Series winner with the San Francisco Giants, World Series MVP, you know, one of the most popular players in baseball, wants to come to Staten Island and be part of the Ferry Hawk experience and bring us a championship.
Wow, that is a win-win-win. I mean... opening weekend is what, May 3rd, 4th, and 5th?
May 3rd, 4th, and 5th. We're calling it Pandemonium in Hawk City out in Staten Island as we welcome a three-time World Series champion to lead our effort to bring a championship to Staten Island.
And there's also rumors that you're trying to make a deal with Mariano Rivera.
There are rumors that we're trying to work to get Mariano out here to come do a first pitch and that we want to be part of what Mariano's trying to build with his foundation and schools in New York City. So... there's a lot going on, but there's more in New Jersey, John. We got a governor's
race. Let's go back to Jersey. Tell us what's going on.
So we had a governor's
race.
And
a senator's race, too.
We have a senator's race. The big news on that is, you know, Senator Menendez's trial starts May 6th, so the state will be consumed by that. But the real big show in New Jersey is past the Senate race. It's the governor's race in 2025. Democrats have been in office for 8 years. Republicans have a very strong primary field. What's interesting is Jack Cittarelli just announced he ran last time. Now he's embracing Donald Trump. He's going to be opposed by State Senator John Bramnick, who is very vocal that he is anti-Trump.
So this is the typical Biden-Trump war.
It is a big matchup with two people staking out very different positions as it relates to Mr. Trump.
The Senate race is only months away. Ms. Murphy dropped out. You got Kim. And Menendez wants to run as an independent.
Menendez is keeping his cards open, playing that close to the vest, threatening to run as an independent, which, you know, could have an impact on the Democrats. I think most people feel this is a Democrat race to lose with Andy Kim now running. But Republicans do have a primary. Their leader is Curtis Bashaw from South Jersey, well-respected developer, you know, worked in the McGreevy administration, heading up Casino Redevelopment Authority. So it'll definitely be a race, but this is one for the Democrats to hold.
Anything else you want to say? We got 30 seconds left.
No, listen, we're excited about opening day with the Ferry Hawks. The New Jersey political scene is really an interesting place right now. And go Ferry Hawks and come see a World Series champion in person.
I am looking forward to my peanuts and Cracker Jacks.
And Nathan's hot dogs.
And Nathan's hot dogs. Thank you so much. You are listening to the Cats Roundtable. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Cats Roundtable. With us today is Steve Cates, otherwise known as Dr. Sky. Steve, tell us what's going on this week.
Well, John, all the big excitement of the total eclipse and partial eclipse across the nation, again, to see this in totality, I just come back from Texas. That was an amazing experience, as many people got to see. We won't see one for quite a number of years in the United States. But, John, always telling the truth here and subject matter, because sometimes, in my opinion, the media might get this just a little bit wrong. And here's what we're going to talk about. It's interesting. There's a star in the heavens that the media purports that will be this exploding star in the sky and that people might be able to see it. Well, it's in the constellation of Corona Borealis, and it's known as T. Corona Borealis. What is it? Every 80 years or so, this red giant and white dwarf combination can flare up in the sky. Well, that's not totally unusual, other than the fact that we call these recurring nova. And there's only five of these known in the galaxy. So while I was harping on the way the media might report it, they may give the impression to people that they can go outside and see this brilliant object. But from the astronomy side, if you had a pair of binoculars, if you look up at a constellation called Corona Borealis, which is high up in the northeast after sunset, sometime this year, John, this star, which is fascinating, it's a red giant, and it spits off material with this little white dwarf next to it. And what does it do? The white dwarf sucks up all this energy, and for reasons we don't know, the mechanism, it blasts this material back out into space and making this star go and look like it's exploding. It's called a recurring nova. Fascinating.
It is. I mean, but give or take a billion years, and we won't be able to see it again.
Absolutely, yes.
This NASA launched the last Delta Heavy rocket?
Absolutely. And here we go. This is an amazing rocket. It's been around for quite a long time. In 64 years, maybe people never noticed it because NASA got all the credit with the Apollos. This is the last of 389 launches. It's a tri-type rocket, meaning it has a central core and two big boosters on the side. But what it did the other day is quite interesting. It launched another National Reconnaissance Office so-called secret satellite into space. That's known officially as NROL-70. Now, what's important about this rocket? The United Launch Alliance, John, has been, you know, manufacturing this really reliable rocket for such a long time. And it's sad to see it go, but yes, they have something even, quote, better on the horizon. It's called the Vulcan rocket, and that will be coming up very soon. Isn't it quite amazing, John? All these different powerful rockets. I mean, we were stuck in the 1960s and 70s with the Saturn V, which is actually a great rocket. But now we're seeing all these rockets. So the Delta IV Heavy goes into the history books. Quite an interesting workhorse in the world of rockets. Fascinating stuff there, too.
Anything going on the moon or Mars?
Well, John, the latest on Mars, a continuation of what I said last week, that the surface of Mars may become more contaminated than we should with old spacecraft. So hopefully people in the future, that is, and I think they got their eye on the ball on this, they're going to be hopefully looking at ways not to pollute the surface of Mars, because the most important thing, and we didn't mention it last week, is let's not pollute the surface of Mars with any Earth bacteria, no matter how much we try, because that might do things that, well, we don't know. But if we're looking for life, let's not pollute it. But here's something, John, that's fascinating. We always talk about the mystery of the week. And here's the most dynamic thing, in my opinion, in the whole universe. Of all the conundrums and all mysteries, the subject of dark matter really comes up. 85% of the entire universe is made up of this dark material that's somewhat a component, we don't know for sure, of gravity. And it helps bind things together. At least that's what astrophysicists and astronomers tell us. But the most amazing thing, John, when we look out, like people who saw the eclipse, whether partial or total, you look out in nature, you see all this beauty with God. Hopefully people have two good eyes. John, we're only seeing about 5% of the entire universe. All that stuff is called baryonic matter. That's a fancy term. But imagine this. In the world of dark matter, something is gluing the galaxies together or holding space together. And even Einstein couldn't figure this out. He called it spooky action at a distance. And it's still one of the most amazing things, John. I wonder your comment on this, because nobody really knows what the heck it is, but somehow they think and really kind of look at this stuff is out in the universe, 85%.
I mean, I still don't understand dark matter. Is it positive matter? Is it real matter?
Nobody knows, John. It's a component of gravity. And when we get into the subject of gravity in our short but important interview here today, somehow, and there was an astronomer, a female, her name was Vera Rubin, and she studied, John, for years in the 1940s and 50s to get a PhD. And unfortunately, at the time, men didn't want to see that particular woman, or women for that matter, get a PhD. But she had the biggest, I think, advance on trying to understand it. So trying to address it today, it's that it's something or component of gravity that makes everything, how do I say this? It's like a glue in the universe, to keep a simple way of describing it. But really, John, nobody knows. Everybody's opinion on this, even the great astrophysicists, I've interviewed so many of them who have the, quote, you know, the leading edge on this. And they're still trying to go and scratch their head saying, what the heck is this? It's something that we don't understand yet. And the bottom line is our whole story of cosmology, you know, how the universe formed, may also have to have a revision, And then the other one is the dark energy. That's even stranger, but also important, that the farther you go out into the universe with the expansion, instead of things slowing down, something again in gravity might be pushing it at accelerating rates where maybe you would think it would slow down. Just mind-boggling for a Sunday.
It is mind-boggling. Now, I've been told by sources, by people that are in the know, that we do have anti-gravity type ships.
John, I would believe you 100%, and not just to agree with you, that there's so much that I think we still don't understand, not to be a conspiracist here, or conspiracy theory guy, but all the stuff about the alien technology. You know, we remember last July, it was admitted in a whistleblower hearing in the Congress, one of the guys, David Grush, said pretty much emphatically that we do have and possess alien spacecraft or alien artifacts and even the bodies. So I wouldn't be surprised, John, if somewhere along the line somebody's laughing right now going, hey, you're right, Steve, Dr. Sky and John, you know, but we're not going to tell you how to figure this out. But wouldn't that be amazing, John? Because if we could, we could
change the world. Well, I hope we live long enough to see it, Dr. Sky. How did Spock used to say, live long and prosper?
Absolutely. And it's always great to be on the Cats Roundtable. Always check us at the Dr. Sky Experience, where, of course, the WABCRadio.com website. Great information, John, as you know, and the listeners also, I appreciate their commentary on astronomy, space, aviation, and weather. And let's not forget American exceptionalism, as you talk about every day, and we believe it right to our core. Man, truth, justice, and the American, way. Thank you so much.
With us today is Dr. Peter Michalos, our in-house genius, and our motto is live long and prosper. Dr. Michalos, what are we doing this week?
Well, this week we're going to talk about a very important topic, and that's cancer screening and how to when to start doing screening and the different tests that you can do to check for screening. And we're going to start off with some of the younger age groups, and one of them is in women. Cervical cancer screening should start at age 25. Really, they say not to do it under 25 because it's extremely rare to have cervical cancer under 25, but the Pap test, named after Dr. Papanikolaou, which has saved millions of women's lives, is a test where they swab an area of the cervix in women, and you can find things out early. Another thing is that people between the ages of 25 and 65 can get a HPV virus, which is a human papillomavirus, and that can be done when you have your GYN exam, and you can catch the precursor to cervical cancer because that can also occur in people's throats. And that can happen sexually transmitted, and people can end up with throat cancer. There's even a vaccine now for HPV. The other cancers are mammograms, and women should definitely start mammograms at age 40. And 45 to 54, they should really be doing it annually. And if you have a strong family history of cancer, you should discuss with your doctor if you should do it at an earlier age. The other thing that you can test for, of course, is colon cancer. And colon, they say to start colonoscopies at age 45. But there are now tests like Cologuard, which basically they take a stool sample and you can find little tiny pieces and DNA fragments of colon cancer with a simple test through the colon. But if it comes back positive, then you do need a colonoscopy to remove any cancerous polyps. And then the other one is for the lung. And they do have low-dose CAT scan screening now. And people who are smokers, age 50 to 80, or smoke at least 20, have a 20-pack year history of smoking, those people can get screened and you can catch it early. And prostate cancer, basically, men should start at age 50 and talk to their healthcare provider. And you can do a test called a PSA test. And if you see that PSA test climbing, you can have a rectal exam where they actually can feel it. But if it is climbing, there is a test called a 3D MRI, which basically does a image of the MRI. And I know people whose PSA was climbing, their doctor said, watch it, but they went and got a 3D MRI and they found a marble-sized lesion sitting in the center of the prostate that they couldn't see normally. Then if you do have a positive test on one of these tests, there's also something called a PET scan. And a PET scan is a test where your whole body, they put a radioactively labeled dye. And if you do have a cancer, it shows up as an increased signal or a bright area, and that shows an increased blood flow because tumors tend to have more blood vessels to feed the rapidly growing cancer, and it shows up. So PET scans can show an area. For example, if you have a nodule on your lung, then you can get a PET scan, and if it lights up like a Christmas tree and it shows up, then you might have to go on and get a biopsy. And things that you can do to reduce your risk of cancer, of course, stay away from all forms of tobacco, try to keep a healthy weight, regular physical activity, eating fruits and vegetables, avoid alcohol, no more than one drink per day for women and no more than two for men, protect the skin, which is our largest organ where we can get skin cancers like melanoma, squamous cell. So do your annual screening minimal if you have light skin twice a year with your dermatologist, and know your family history and know your risk. And of course, we've talked about on this show the blood tests now that exist, like the Galleri test by Grail, where you can catch 50 cancers before they even start with one simple blood test. And that eventually, by now, it's not covered by insurance, but eventually it will be part of regular screenings, and it will save the system lots of money. Because when you catch things early, you treat early, your survival rate is very high.
The Galleri test, does that include all the other tests? I mean, can you skip the other tests by taking the Galleri test, or those have to be done separately?
Well, the Galleri test is cells start appearing in your bloodstream, so you're catching things a little bit more ahead. Whereas a colon test, for example, the colonoscopy, you can catch a polyp when the cancer is still very early on the tip of the polyp and it hasn't invaded yet or hasn't gotten into your bloodstream. So some of these tests can catch things super, super early, like the Pap test. You can catch a cervical cancer when the cells are right on the surface before they've even invaded or gotten into the bloodstream. It's just another test that helps. For example, there was a lady who wasn't feeling well, and I told her, go see your doctor, get a Galleri test, and it came back positive ovarian signal. The doctor said, oh, don't worry about it, but she went, got the MRI. One ovary was bigger than the other. And guess what? They took out the one ovary. It was filled with cancer, but she caught it so early, she's going to go on to have a normal life. Whereas with ovarian cancer, if it spread, it would have been a disaster. And another, I had a friend in Florida. His doctor told him, don't worry about it. His PSA was 5. I said, get a Galleri test. Guess what? Came back positive, got a 3D MRI, marble side lesion inside the center of his prostate. Had his prostate removed. Why? Because his father had died of metastatic prostate cancer and had severe bone pain from it. So he caught it early. His PSA is 0 now, and he'll go on to live a normal life. So these new tests will be the mainstay in the future. And there's even tests that you can find your risk just testing your microbiome.
How do you spell Galleri?
G-A-L-L-E-R-I test by Grail. And it comes right up. But again, it's a great thing to catch early. And even if you swab your mouth now, certain bacteria in your mouth, if you find a high number of certain bacteria, it can warn you of early pancreatic, colon, stomach cancer. So even the gut microbes are going to be a future signal of what is going on inside your body.
Dr. Peter Michalos, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for always getting the truth out on the Cats Roundtable, where we want people to live long and prosper.
Thank you for being with us for the Cats Roundtable Local Edition, the number one show on Sunday mornings in New York. Keep listening to us for the Cats Roundtable National Edition between 9 o'clock and 10 o'clock. So we'll be back to you in a few minutes after the news.